Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Black Hills Corporation is celebrating its 135th anniversary. Headquartered in Rapid City, the corporation serves 1.25 million electric and natural gas customers in 8 states. David R. Emery is the chairman and CEO of Black Hills Corp. He was this morning's guest for the Morning Philip at the Garage in Rapid City, where the conversation focused on building community, economic development, leadership insights, and his family's contribution to the preservation of Lakota language and music. Morning Philip is brought to you by the NUMAD Group with support from the Bush Foundation. David Emery joins us now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in downtown Rapid City. David Emery, welcome back to the program. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about 135 years of this company, and you've been really more than 3 decades at Black Hills Corporation. Tell me how you first sort of got in the door and what you were looking for when you first chose to be part of that team.
Yeah, interestingly, both my grandfather and dad worked for the company, so I've been exposed to it really my whole life. I was a petroleum engineering major in college, and so I went to work in the oil and gas industry and really didn't expect that there would be an opportunity for me at Black Hills. And then in 86, Black Hills bought an oil and gas subsidiary. So kind of a long story, but someone that I used to work with at my previous employer was hired as an operations manager in Wyoming for the oil and gas company of Black Hills. I was working and living in Fort Worth at the time and applied for a job and got one there in 1989. So I started on that side of the business.
So we've talked before, and I hope in this conversation we can talk again about some of those, you know, your grandfather and growing up with some of the language and the music and the stories that you did. But now that I know there was also a family connection to this company, what were some of those stories like? Just the everyday dad's home from work kind of stories that you remember from being a kid.
Well, my grandfather worked in the power plants primarily as an electrician and maintenance worker. And so, you know, that side of it, I don't have a whole lot. But my dad was a district manager, first in Hot Springs. He started as an accountant, but then a district manager in Hot Springs and then eventually Custer. And at the time he retired, he was running kind of the Southern Hills District. So northeast Wyoming and then all of the southern Black Hills south of Rapid City. You know, those days were different, obviously, but one of the things I remember most is just, you know, the interaction in small communities of being a utility manager. So stories like people who had been disconnected because they didn't pay their bill would show up at the door with cash on, you know, Saturday morning wanting to get reconnected for service. And then storm outages where when I was younger, I thought it was great adventure to go, you know, with my dad driving around and walking around on snowshoes looking for down power lines and things like that. So those were great experiences, I think, that left a positive impression on me as I grew up. But again, I never thought I'd end up working there.
Right.
Not because the impression wasn't positive, but yeah, it just worked out that way.
Which brings up a point about outages. And, you know, when we see in other communities, we watch, you know, a hurricane come through or a large scale disaster, how vital and important it is to restore power and what can happen if that does not go well. How do you poise for something that you really, you know, that you can't quite plan for? Can you plan for it? How do you sort of to look at, you know, I don't know, how many customers do you have? 800 communities in 8 states, more than 1 million customers. You have to be ready for everything in some ways.
Yeah, on the electric side, I think the electric utility and even the gas have mutual assistance programs that are really pretty phenomenal. Right? So the more recent examples in Florida, linemen came there from 37, 38 states from around the country. The industry trade organizations help facilitate a lot of that, and then there is a formal mutual assistance network, if you will. When you have a big storm, and we've had crews in Florida. We didn't have them this last time, but the last round of hurricanes down there, we had a group working last summer pretty extensively, where basically everyone volunteers their crews, and they either call on you or they don't, depending on how many people they need. The only circumstance that we had that required significant pre-planning for a real significant storm in the last quite a few years was when we had Winter Storm Atlas a few years ago. We knew that storm was coming. We knew it was going to be bad. So we talked to all the neighbors in advance and had them start moving crews and poles and materials and supplies in our direction. So as soon as the storm hit, we had, you know, many more people than just our crews ready to go out immediately and start restoring service. We brought up all of our crews from Colorado and Wyoming and had them come as well, plus most of the neighbor utilities sent crews also.
Yeah. So when you're sort of traipsing through the snow with your dad as a little kid, do you have a sense, did he talk to you at all about the importance of what you were actually doing, or was it just kind of an adventure? I mean, when did you start making the connection between, hey, if we don't do our jobs well, real people are going to suffer?
Well, when you're a kid, I think you notice, I would say outages were more of an adventure. You know, yeah. You got to light candles and, you know, do sorts of things. So the seriousness of, you know, people who needed serious medical care and all those things, you know, life-saving equipment, et cetera, wasn't really top of mind, I don't think, as a youngster. Yeah. Certainly for us today, it's a huge issue, and we're very aware of that. We focus a lot on reliability of our system, and that's measured by the number of outage minutes. And our goal is to always be in the top quartile in the country with all three of our electric utilities as far as the fewest number of outage minutes, and we've been successful. In a couple of years, literally, we've had one of our utilities be the most reliable in the United States. So it's a key focus, again, understanding the repercussions, I think, if power's not available, what that means.
When does the headquarters come to Rapid City? What's the impact of that decision of sort of building, you know, this significant community and economic force right there in Rapid?
You know, as we've grown over the years and continue to acquire additional utilities, a lot of the utilities we acquired were relatively small. And so maintaining separate corporate structures for each of those, accounting, finance, you know, a lot of the basics, billing, payment processing, things like that, we've centralized that over the years here in Rapid City, but it was in five separate buildings. As time went on, we'd fill one up and lease another or build another and just kept getting more and more spread out. We were centralized, but we weren't very efficient that way. And so the decision to build a consolidated headquarters here, and we moved in about a year ago. It was early November. We started moving in. It's been very beneficial. I think we can much more efficiently serve our customers across that entire footprint from, you know, Arkansas to Northwest Wyoming and everything in between.
There are many challenges to this industry. What do you see, you know, everything from workforce development to a sustainable business model to a sustainable environmental model? What do you see as some of the immediate challenges for Black Hills Corporation, and how are you addressing them?
A couple things. I think one of those is the utility industry is not like several other industries in that we have a very large group of, you know, baby boomers, if you will, in the workforce, and they're in the process of transitioning out. So 5 years ago, we had a third or more of our workforce that could retire in 5 years. Now that number is probably down to 20%, but it's still a pretty large portion of our population to hire and train and replace that knowledge. So we might have a third of our workforce leave, but we would say have 70, 80% of our experience years leave. And so that's been a real challenge, and we've been putting a lot of time and effort into how do we better train those employees, and then also how do we use technology to make information more readily available to them. So things like even be able to FaceTime each other on an iPad where they can FaceTime the more experienced person if they're having a problem, you know, those sorts of things. So the workforce transition's one. I think the other is the implication of policy, environmental policy and energy policy in general, and what that does from a customer and customer impact perspective. So in some states, there's more pressure there than others, but in Colorado's a great example. They have a very aggressive environmental policy statewide there, and it causes pretty significant cost increases for customers.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about climate change and some of that economic impact on the customer if things are not handled properly. We've talked about that before, but now that the special report from the United Nations panel sort of said this is a, you know, an ear-splitting wake-up call on climate change. In your industry, how do you sort of read the data like that, saying, you know, it's running faster than we are and we're running out of time? How do you hear a wake-up call like that in what you do?
You know, I think one thing that's important to put into perspective, and you read those reports, and there is this increased sense of urgency, if you will. I think urgency in the perspective of climate change isn't really measured or shouldn't be measured in days and months and even years. I mean, these are decade-long issues, multiple decade-long issues. And you could stop emitting CO2 today, and it's going to take several decades to have any meaningful change in the temperature of the planet. And that's by really any report. So I think the key is collectively as an industry, can we implement changes over a 2-3-4-decade period of time to get where we want to go and yet still keep it affordable and allow the technology to be developed that makes it possible?
Right.
That technology is not developed today that solves all those issues, right? Renewables are generally intermittent. Battery storage is nowhere near where it needs to be fully functional and operate on a renewable-only energy platform. We have to use fossil fuels still. We have to use nuclear still. You can't transition the entire energy infrastructure in a short period of time.
Right. Is that technology, that research and development, is that part of Black Hills Corporation's business model? Is that, explain to me how that fits into your operations.
You know, it's interesting. We're a relatively small utility. If you look at the 50 or so publicly traded utilities, we're probably in the bottom 10 from a size perspective. And the large ones are 20 times bigger than we are. So we don't have what I would call big research budgets at Black Hills.
Yeah.
But one of the things we do is we're small and pretty agile. And so we've been involved over the years in a lot of technology developments because we're small and we can react quickly. So people want to use our sites as test sites, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Black Hills built the first air-cooled condensing coal plant in the Western Hemisphere in the late 60s in Gillette, Wyoming, right? Power generation takes a lot of water, and so to build a technology, basically brought the technology from Europe and proved it up in Wyoming. We've been the prototype for low nitrous oxide burners in power plants. We've been one of the first plants in the country to have mercury scrubbing technology in service. So we've been, because of our size and because of our willingness to experiment, if you will, we've been pretty involved in some of those without a quote-unquote research department.
Mm. When you talk about policy and the impact that it can have, you know, on a state basis, you know, say the difference between South Dakota's regulations and Colorado's, what's the impact of federal policy on your day-to-day operations and sort of how you have to look at things? And how much does it change between, you know, one administration comes through and pushes things in one direction, another president comes through and pushes things in a different direction? Does that roll down to you in a significant way, or are you a more steady ship than that, really?
I'm sorry, my headset went dead as you were talking,
yeah.
And they handed me another one, so I'm going to have you repeat that question, please.
No worries, and I'll sum it up because I'm talking about sort of federal policy versus state policy. How much do you have to respond to a new presidential administration, for example, that, you know, sort of reverses things of the last administration? How important is that federal policy to your operations, or is it mostly just state by state that is a greater impact?
But both have a huge impact on our business. Yes, we have to comply with federal regulations and federal legislation, but our actual process for approving the types of generation that we use to serve our customers, how those costs get recovered in our rates to customers, all of that is done on a state-by-state basis at the Public Utility Commission level.
Yeah.
So the compliance issues, and I think environmental regulation is a good example, I would say we really haven't seen any change there with the change in administration. We've seen a lot of, I would call, more administrative-type reductions in effort,
mm-hmm.
but the rules themselves are the same. So emissions, for example, CO2, the regulations basically preclude anyone from building a new coal plant today unless there's an emissions capture technology deployed. That hasn't changed. The clean power plan that the Obama administration had advanced previously, that was already put on hold by the courts anyway.
Okay.
And so that really hasn't changed either. Nothing's happening with it, but nothing was happening before either. So we haven't seen much there. Then it just gets down to state by state. Some states, Colorado being an example, have a very aggressive renewable mandate. Other states like Wyoming and South Dakota do not, and they're more interested in doing it slowly and gradually and trying to select the resources that are cheapest for customers. Mm-hmm. And that's what the standard that they hold us to. And so we really have to be willing and able to basically accommodate state by state what we need to do in order to satisfy the utilities commissions and respective state policies and regulations while still under the federal umbrella.
As you look at the work that you're doing today as a leader of a corporation and a leader in a community, are there things that you have learned through experience that you pass on to other people who are sort of trying to find their way in leadership, as CEOs of different companies? Do you give out, people ask you for advice often?
Yeah, sometimes. A couple things. We've got industry groups where the CEOs, both on the electric utility and the gas utility side, get together.
Yeah.
And whether that's leadership experiences, things going on in our companies, whatever, we typically meet as a group at least four times a year for each of those two industries. And a lot of overlap because a lot of those companies are combination companies like we are. So that's certainly an area where we get and receive and give and receive advice. The other side is just in the people development side. And yeah. So, for example, at Black Hills, we have a pretty extensive leadership development program there. We teach our own internally developed program to all of our younger managers and supervisors. And then we work really hard at people development all the way up through that. And so with that group, I have an opportunity to discuss regularly, you know, words of advice, if you will, and what things to do and not do. And I think the most important thing is to just be open and honest and upfront with people, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be clear about what you expect, and then you have to give them the freedom to step up and lead and accomplish it themselves.
Yeah. Do you have favorite books that you pass out? Favorite speakers that you say, you know, this person always provides insight for me? Who's helped you get to where you are today?
I would say most of my experience, and I've read a ton of,
right,
obviously, management books and leadership books. I wouldn't say any of them really stand out to me. I think to me it's more my experiences. Having seen and worked with a couple pretty good leaders, I think was probably more inspiring and more informative to me. If I read anything in a book subsequent to that, it probably reinforced it. And I'm not sure how much new I got, really. It's really just seeing someone who's very good at it, teaches in a very effective way, at least for me, more so than reading it.
Yeah. I'd be remiss to let you go without talking about your family's efforts to preserve Lakota music and Lakota culture. And I'd also direct people to our website for the conversation we had previously on this topic. But let people know how this sort of digitization project is going. It's a partnership with the South Dakota Hall of Fame and the work that your grandfather did in gathering on this reel-to-reel tape all these voices and music. Where does that stand right now?
Yeah, the collection, as we've discussed before, basically was a compilation from the 1950s until 1977, where my grandfather went around and recorded Lakota stories and songs and ceremonies, and not just Lakota people, you know, other surrounding tribes as well, and recorded that mainly with the idea of preservation, one, a preservation of the stories and the songs and the language, and my grandpa was also a Lakota language instructor. So that was a huge effort on his part, recognizing that those stories and things might be lost. So the effort then was to get those tapes converted to digital, which my dad and Crazy Horse Monument actually undertook, got them all converted from reel to reel to CD, And my dad copied those, distributed them to all the universities in the state, the tribal colleges in the state. And now the effort of South Dakota Hall of Fame is to take those and get them put on their website so they're available to anyone, anywhere. Hmm. And I think there's 70-some discs that have been converted and are available on their Hall of Fame website, and there's a continuation to get all 300-plus of those discs done over time, but it's probably going to take a year, maybe longer than that, to get all that work accomplished.